This week we are beginning with chapter 6, and I'm going to finish that chapter tonight. We've been doing two sessions per chapter. If we keep that up with every chapter, we're going to be a long time getting through this book. So there are some chapters I feel like I can get through in one. This is one particular one I think I can do, because many of the stories that we're dealing with tonight are stories that you are very familiar with, and then we can spend more time, next time when we get together, we're actually going to begin talking about the Exodus. We have been speaking about Abraham for the last 2 weeks and our father in faith. We saw that Abraham was a tribal chieftain. He was originally from the Ur of the Chaldees. He and his father Terah and their family traveled from Ur up to Haran, and then Terah passed away there, died there. It was there in Haran that God first spoke to Abram and said to him that I am going to lead you to another place. I want you to leave the home of your forefathers. And Abraham said yes. Abraham, they're the same person. But he says yes. And this is what Abraham always does. Abraham always says yes. He sometimes questions and like, Lord, I don't understand this. What's this all about? Because God asks him to do some pretty amazing things. But he always says yes, no matter how difficult that is, no matter how outlandish it is. Abraham always says yes to God. We went through and looked at a number of incidents in his life, and one of the things that we've addressed a lot in the last couple of weeks is that issue of we want our heroes to be always heroes, and it's uncomfortable when we see that they have chinks in their armor, and that when we see somebody like Abraham, who we admire and who we respect, but then he'll turn around and do something that just appalls us, you know, twice prostituting Sarah out in order to protect his own life. And we've just got to understand it was a different time. It was a different era. This is before they have received the Ten Commandments. Abram is the first to begin to emerge from the darkness of paganism. He is still very much influenced by the thought processes and the attitudes of his time. Those attitudes, which are being very patriarchal, do not highly esteem the value of women, and that women basically are property and they are there for the enhancement of the honor of the man. And so we're very bothered by that, and we should be bothered by that, because there have been thousands of years that have gone since that time, thousands of years of revelation with the whole rest of the Bible, as we begin to see more and more of what God's actual plan is, and of the moral teachings of the scriptures, especially when we come to the New Testament, to the gospel. Same thing we saw is that in our understanding of God, there are many ways in which the God that we are encountering in this first book of the Bible is a disturbing image of God. There are things about this God that we don't like. Somebody asked last week about the vengeance of God. And the vengeance of God, I think I tried to address, is really the justice of God. As I was thinking about this this past week, here's an image that helps me to see what we're dealing with. Imagine that I'm an artist who does great art with mosaic. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a great mosaic of the image of Christ. And so I begin with these colored tiles that I'm going to use. But I've only got a handful of the colored tiles. I don't have all of the tiles. I'm going to have to gather all of those tiles. And all I have are the first ones are kind of some harsh colors. But that's what I begin with. So I begin to put those where they need to be. But then there are going to be many other tiles that are going to come along that are going to contrast with those particular tiles, are going to soften the influence of those tiles, and we're going to get a broader picture. That's where we are. That's where we are at this point, at the beginning of the Bible, as we're looking here at Genesis. They are just starting to come to know who this God is. And they only have a few of the pieces. They only have a few of the pieces. The whole rest of the Bible, the entire revelation that's going to come, and again, especially the New Testament, for Christ is the fullness of revelation. He is the fullness of the Word of God. It is only in Christ that we are going to see the most complete picture of God that we are going to have. And so we've got to understand the images that we're getting now are the first time. tiles, by the first tiles. Now, they're true, but they're true in terms of their relative relationship to all the other tiles that are going to come along as we go through. Does this make sense to you? All right? So you got to understand. The other thing we have to understand always as we go through here is that the language that we use to talk about God is not God. The images that we have of God are not God. Everything that we say about God is inadequate to actually describe God. Everything that we believe, all of the doctrines that the Catholic Church proclaims about God are true, but they are radically inadequate to truly describe God. As soon as you think you've got God figured out, you are dead wrong. You are dead wrong. You can count on that. Any God that you think you can grasp and understand is not the God of the Bible. Because if there is one truth that we must understand about God, is that He is mystery. He is above and beyond. He is other. He is other than us. He tells us very clearly, "My ways are not your ways." The way God sees is not the way that we see. Again, can you imagine an ant trying to understand human beings? All right? And all they've got is the experience of ant life to work with, all right? And the images that come from their interactions, that's all they've got. They're trying to describe something that's so far beyond them. Did you ever watch, I remember just several, like maybe a year ago or so, and I saw on PBS, they were doing this story on string theory. You ever, you know what string theory is? This kind of new theory of physics, of the unifying theory of physics. And I don't understand it whatsoever. I watched the show, and I was like, I have no clue what they're talking about. This is so far beyond me, all right, and my understanding, that I don't get it at all. Well, that's just the reality with God. That's the reality with God. Everything that we know about God points towards God, but it's not God. All right? Everything, all the language that we use about God really comes from our human experience, and we apply it in analogy to God. But God is always beyond. He is always beyond. So there's where we are. Now, what we're going to do tonight is we're going to go through the rest of the patriarchs. We've dealt with Abraham. We're going to just see him very briefly in the last couple of scenes of his life. And then we are going to deal with Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. It's going to be a whirlwind tour. We're going to cover a lot of things tonight. Abraham, towards the end of his life, sees his son Isaac, who is now an adult, and recognizes that he needs to make sure that he has a good wife. Now, they are living in the land of Canaan, which is a pagan territory, and is a foreign country for them. They are foreigners in this country, and so the Canaanites are a people that are not only religiously different, they are culturally different, and they are racially different. And so what Abraham says to his servant is, I want you to make sure that my son Isaac does not end up married to one of these Canaanites. So what I want you to do is I want you to go back to the land of my forefathers, the land of the Ur of the Chaldees, in that area, and I want you to find a wife for her from among our own people, or a wife for him, for my son Isaac. So that's what he does. He goes back, and he gets there to the area, and he comes to what we now call Rachel's Well. There is a well there. Wells are very important in that part of the country, in that part of the world, because it is very dry, desert land. And where there is a well, that's where life is going to start springing up. And they can't keep water. There's not running water. So every day they have to go to the well. And usually it's the woman who does that. The husband's out in the fields doing whatever. It's the wife who is usually the who is going to the well. The daughters who are going to the well, gathering the water, getting the water and going back. And so it becomes a town gathering place, right, where everybody kind of catches up on the news and the gossip, whatever, becomes a gathering place. So this is where Abraham's servant comes to. And Rachel, this woman, shows up. And he recognizes that she is a very attractive woman, and he comes and starts talking to her. He discovers that she is the granddaughter of Nahor. And Nahor is Abraham's brother. So this is the great niece of Abraham. All right. Now, again, part of what we are uncomfortable with is some of the closeness of these marriages. But that was not unusual in that time. All right. They did not have the same kind of squeamishness about marrying cousins that we do. All right. In fact, marrying within the family circles to some extent was what was expected and what was wanted. All right. For one reason, if you marry within your family, property is important. All right? And if you marry outside the family, then family property may very well be lost to the tribe and to the family. It may end up in somebody else's family. If you keep marriages somewhat close, then the property stays close and the money stays close, all right? And that's how you survive. So very often there is kind of this type of marriage. So we find out that she is the granddaughter of Nahor, Abraham's brother. Her father is now deceased, but she has a brother whose name is Laban, who is head of the family. Her mother is still alive, but Laban is head of the family. So he meets with Laban and begins to tell him about how God has blessed Abraham, how he is incredibly wealthy, how he has many servants and slaves, and how he has much property, and he has many animals, and he's got sheep and everything else. And Laban understands that this is a good marriage for his sister. First of all, that she is going to be well taken care of, but also it's our own folk, all right? And so it's our own family. You know, we know the character of these people. This is a good marriage. He arranges this marriage to Isaac. She goes back to Canaan, to the land of Canaan, and marries Isaac. After this is the death of Abraham. He dies at 175 years old. Sarah has died sometime before that. They are buried together there in the land of Canaan. So Isaac marries Rebecca. Now, for a while, they have trouble having any kids, and that's where we're going to pick up, and we're going to begin with chapter 25 of Genesis, verse 19, the birth of Esau and Jacob. Genesis 25, verse 19. This is the family history of Isaac, son of Abraham. Abraham had begotten Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, and the sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac entreated the Lord on behalf of his wife, since she was sterile. The Lord heard his entreaty, and Rebekah became pregnant. But the children in her womb, the children in her womb jostled each other so much that she exclaimed, "If this is to be so, what good will it do me?" She's having a rough pregnancy, all right? She went to consult the Lord, and he answered her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples are quarreling while still within you." All right, one is going to be the nation of Israel. The other is going to be the nation of Edom. All right, is going to be the descendants of Esau. Edom is going to be a nation that coexisted with Israel, but was dominated by Israel and kind of under their subjection. They will eventually overthrow the Israelites, as we're going to see in this prophecy. Two peoples are quarreling while still within you, but one shall surpass the other. Jacob will surpass Esau, and the older Esau shall serve the younger. When the time of her delivery came, there were twins in her womb. The first who emerged was reddish. This is Esau. He's a wild man. He's a wild man. He comes out, he is red, ruddy, and his whole body was like a hairy mantle. He comes out, he's hairy already, all right? He's a hairy baby, all right? Like this little wild animal. So they named him Esau. His brother came out next, gripping Esau's heel. So they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. As the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter. A man who lived in the open. He's a man's man, all right? That's who Esau is. I mean, he's this wild man. He's this tough. He's a hunter. He's out there. Whereas Jacob was a simple man who kept to his tents. Isaac preferred Esau. He relates to him. This is my boy, my boy. But Rebecca preferred Jacob. Moms like nice boys, all right? They do. That's true, all right? Moms like nice boys. Dads like football players, all right? Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the open, famished. He said to Jacob, "Let me gulp down some of that red stuff." I love the way they said that, all right? "Let me get some of that red stuff. I don't know what it is, but it looks good. I'm starving." That's why he was called Edom, which I'm not... something connected with hunger. But Jacob replied, first give me your birthright in exchange for it. Now, I don't know if we've talked about birthright here or not. We need to stop and talk about what this is. This has to do with being the firstborn. And it is a very important principle in the family ethos of the Middle East. Again, we're talking about a patriarchal culture. And what would happen is that the firstborn male would inherit everything. Everything, all of the property, all right, and all of the authority of the father. Now, that's not just for him. Within a patriarchal culture, the reason he inherits is that he now is responsible for everybody. He is responsible, having inherited, he is responsible to make sure that everybody else has a job and everybody else is getting fed and being taken care of. So, yes, he inherits the wealth, but he also inherits the responsibility, all right, and that's the way that works. Now, one of the things that shows up over and over in the scriptures is the reversal, where it's not the elder one that ends up being the favored one, but it is the younger who ends up being the favored. The whole thing is turned upside down. We see this with the first ones, with Cain and Abel. All right, Cain comes first, all right, but he becomes the murderer because Abel is the one whose sacrifice is preferred by God. And so he kills his brother. And then Seth, the next one, is the one who becomes the favored one, while Cain is cast out east of Eden, right? So we see it there. We're going to see it later on as we go through even today with some of the other stories, but we're going to see this also when we come to the Moses story. This is going to be true with the David story, where he is the youngest of this whole clan, but he is the one that God has chosen over and over and over. God reverses this. He chooses the weakest. He chooses the last, not the first. God does not play by our rules. He just simply refuses to play by our rules. And so this is the birthright. This is the birthright that he inherits everything. First give me your birthright in exchange for it. For soup? For stew? All right? But Esau, you know, is not a very bright guy. All right? And he says, look, said Esau, I'm on the point of dying. What good will any birthright do me? But Jacob insisted, swear to me first. So he told Jacob, sold Jacob his birthright under oath. Jacob then gave him some bread and the lentil stew, and Esau ate, drank it up, and went his way. Esau cared little for his birthright. It just didn't, you know, he just took everything for granted. You know, he's not even thinking about the future whatsoever. Now we're going to jump over to chapter 27, verse 1, where we're going to see the next chapter of the story, which is actually many years later. All right, many years later, Esau undoubtedly has forgotten this whole first incident, forgotten this whole selling his birthright, didn't take it seriously to begin with. It's like, shut up, little brother, give me something to eat. All right, I'll tell you anything I have to tell you, but I don't mean it. But I don't mean it. And it probably wouldn't have meant a great deal. It probably wouldn't have meant a great deal. If Jacob had gone to his dad and said, Esau sold me his birthright, he would have said, he can't do that. I get to decide who gets the birthright. He can't sell what is not yet in his own possession. All right. Once I give it to him, he could give it to you. But until then, this is mine. This is mine. So Jacob has another way. And he's going to have the cooperation of his mother. Now I wonder, I think about this, can you imagine poor Esau? This is his mother. This is his mother who is going to be conniving and scheming behind his back to take away from him his birthright, all right, as the firstborn son, and to give it to her little darling. All right? And can you imagine the years of therapy this boy is going to need, all right, to deal with having this woman as your mother, all right? This is almost like having Lady Macbeth as your mom, all right? It's not obviously going to be a real healthy experience for him. When Isaac was so old that his eyesight had failed him, he called his older son Esau and said to him, son, yes, father, he replied. Isaac then said, as you can see, I am old, that I may now die at any time. Take your gear, therefore, your quiver and bow, and go out into the country to hunt some game for me. With your catch, prepare an appetizing dish for me, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my special blessing before I die. Rebecca had been listening while Isaac was speaking to his son Esau. So when Esau went out into the country to hunt some game for his father, Rebecca said to her son Jacob, "Listen, I overheard your father tell your brother Esau, bring me some game and with it prepare an appetizing dish for me to eat that I may give you my blessing with the Lord's approval before I die. Now, son, listen carefully to what I tell you. I'm in charge." This is a patriarchal culture, all right, which means that officially, all power is in the hands of men. But in all patriarchal cultures, there have been women who knew how to get their way. All right? They knew how to get their way. We saw this with Sarah. All right? Sarah, again, according to the ethos of the time, was little more than a servant to her husband, all right? That she was essentially property, but she knew how to get what she wanted. You know, the saying that we have today, which is, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, all right? Well, that applied back then, all right? And so mama knew how to make daddy miserable enough until he gave her what she wanted, all right? So women, even under this kind of a patriarchal culture, knew how to exercise their own brand of power. Now, son, listen carefully to what I tell you. Go to the flock and get me 2 choice kids. With these I will prepare an appetizing dish for your father, such as he likes. Then bring it to your father to eat, that he may bless you before he dies. But my brother Esau is a hairy man, said Jacob to his mother Rebekah, and I am smooth-skinned. Suppose my father feels me. He will think I am making sport of him, and I shall bring on myself a curse instead of a blessing. And they believed that the curses were just as serious as the blessings were. All right? His mother, however, replied, "Let any curse against you, son, fall on me. Just do as I say. Go and get me the kids." So Jacob went and got them and brought them to his mother, and with them she prepared an appetizing dish such as his father liked. Rebekah then took the best clothes of her older son Esau that she had in the house and gave them to her younger son Jacob to wear. And with the skins of the kids, she covered up his hands and the hairless parts of his neck. Then she handed her son Jacob the appetizing dish and the bread she had prepared. Bringing them to his father, Jacob said, "Father." "Yes," replied Isaac. "Which of my sons are you?" Jacob answered his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I did as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your special blessing." But Isaac asked, "How did you succeed so quickly, son?" He answered, "The Lord your God let things turn out well with me." Isaac then said to Jacob, "Come closer, son, that I may feel you, to learn whether you really are my son Esau or not." So Jacob moved up closer to his father. When Isaac felt him, he said, "Although the voice is Jacob's, the hands are Esau's." He failed to identify him because his hands were hairy, like those of his brother Esau. So in the end, he gave him his blessing. Again he asked him, "Are you really my son Esau?" "Certainly," he replied. Then Isaac said, "Serve me your game, son, that I may eat of it and then give you my blessing." Jacob served it to him, and Isaac ate. He brought him wine, and he drank. Finally, his father Isaac said to him, "Come closer, son, and kiss me." As Jacob went up and kissed him, Isaac smelled the fragrance of his clothes. All right, these are dirty clothes, all right? That's why he's smelling fragrance. With that, he blessed him, saying, "All the fragrance of my son is like the fragrance of a field that the Lord has blessed." Remember, he's the outdoorsman, so he smells like the outdoors. "May God give to you of the dew of the heavens and of the fertility of the earth abundance of grain and wine. Now here's the blessing. Let people serve you and nations pay you homage. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you." Jacob had scarcely left his father, just after Isaac had finished blessing him, when his brother Esau came back from his hunt. Then he too prepared an appetizing dish with his game, and bringing it to his father, he said, "Please, father, eat some of your son's game, that you may then give me your special blessing." "Who are you?" his father asked. Isaac asked him. "I am Esau," he replied, "your firstborn son." With that, Isaac was seized with a fit of uncontrollable trembling. "Who was it then," he asked, "that hunted game and brought it to me? I finished eating it just before you came, and I blessed him. Now he must remain blessed." All right? Again, for us, we would say, just take it back. He can't. Once it's given, it's given. All right? Once it's out there, the blessing, once it's out there, the person who has given it can't bring it back. The same thing with a curse. All right? Once the curse has been cast out, it has its own power. It has its own authority and cannot be brought back. On hearing his father's words, Esau burst into loud, bitter sobbing. "Father, bless me too," he begged. When Isaac explained, "Your brother came here by a ruse and carried off your blessing," Esau exclaimed, He has been well named Jacob. His name has something to do with deceit. He has now supplanted me twice. First he took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing. Then he pleaded, haven't you saved a blessing for me? Isaac replied, I have already appointed him your master, and I have assigned to him all his kinsmen and his slaves. Beside, I have enriched him with grain and wine. What then can I do for you, son? But Esau urged his father, have you only that one blessing, father? Bless me too. Isaac, however, made no reply, and Esau wept aloud. Finally, Isaac spoke again and said to him, ah, far from the fertile earth shall be your dwelling. The earth's not going to cooperate well with you. This is almost a curse. Far from the dew of the heavens above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But when you become restive, you shall throw off his yoke from your neck. He's talking about your descendants. Your descendants will be under the domination of the descendants of your son, the Israelites, but they will throw them off. They will rebel against him, and they will have their freedom. Esau bore Jacob a grudge. Yes, he certainly did. All right, and we're not going to get into all of that, but at one point, Jacob has to flee for his life because Esau is coming after him with hundreds of men in order to kill him. He said to himself, when the time of mourning for my father comes, I will kill my brother Jacob. When Rebekah got news of what her older son Esau had in mind, she called her younger son Jacob and said to him, listen, your brother Esau intends to settle accounts with you by killing you. Therefore, son, do what I tell you. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides, until your brother's anger against you. Until your brother's anger against you subsides and he forgets what you did to him. He's not going to forget. All right? Then I will send for you and bring you back. Must I lose both of you in a single day? So he goes to Laban. On the way, he has an experience which is a very memorable one. We're going to jump over to, it's chapter 28, verse 10. This is Jacob's dream at the location that will be known as Bethel. He's on his way to Haran, all right, to Laban, who is his uncle, the brother of his mother. Jacob departed from Beersheba and proceeded toward Haran. When he came upon a certain shrine, as the sun was already set, he stopped there for the night. Taking one of the stones at the shrine, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep at that spot. Then he had a dream. A stairway rested on the ground with its top reaching to the heavens. Stairway to heaven. That's where that comes from. That's where that image comes from in the song. And God's messengers were going up and down on it. So he sees angels going up and down the stairway. Other translations actually describe it as a ladder, all right, rather than a stairway. And it is more traditionally known as Jacob's ladder, all right, Jacob's ladder. It becomes an image in the early church especially of the life of prayer, all right, this ladder to God, the stairway to heaven, all right. And that prayer is a steady progress towards of growing our relationship with God, of climbing rung by rung by rung up to heaven, up to union with God. So there was the Lord standing beside him and saying, I, the Lord, am the God of your forefather Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you are lying, I will give to you and your descendants. This is the same promise he has given to Abraham before him. These shall be as plentiful as the dust of the earth, and through them you shall spread out east and west, north and south, and you and your descendants, all the nations of the earth, shall find blessing. Know that I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go and bring you back to this land. I will never leave you until I have done what I promised you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he exclaimed, truly the Lord is in this spot, although I did not know it. In solemn wonder, he cried out, how awesome is this shrine. There is nothing. This is nothing else but an abode of God, and that is the gateway to heaven. Okay, so then he's going to go on to Haran. While he is in Haran, he is going to also be looking for a wife. All right, remember, as his father went back to the land of their ancestors looking for a wife, so he is going to do the same thing, looking for a wife among his own people, the people of his own race, of his own tribe, of his own culture, really of his own people, his own family. So he goes, and he sees a woman. I'm not going going to go through each of this, read through the story. I'm just going to talk about the story. This is a great story, too. You need to read all of this. I can't cover every single part of this, but please read all of it and read it carefully and read it with great delight. These are great stories. These are fantastic stories. Even if they were not scripture, they would just be great stories, all right? But there is also the great benefit that they are also the Word of God, which is revealing His truth to us. So he comes to Haran, where Laban is living, and he sees Laban's younger daughter, Rachel, and falls head over heels in love with her. And so he goes to Laban and says, I want to marry your daughter. And Laban says, sounds good to me, but you're going to have to earn her. And you're going to have to earn her by working for me for 7 years. And after 7 years, you will be able to marry her. All right. Now, he's in no hurry to get back home because Esau's looking for him. All right. So he said, okay, I'm fine. All right. There's nothing except death waiting on me back home. So I'm perfectly okay to stay here for 7 years and work for you, which he does. And the scripture says he was so in love with her that the time just flew. All right. You just know how you are when you're in love. You're just stupid. All right. And that's the way it was. So he just worked. He worked and worked because he was so in love with Rachel. But Laban has this older daughter named Leah. And Leah is not beautiful, all right? And he's like, well, you know, it's not right that this younger daughter should be married before her older sister. Again, in that culture, that's not the way it's supposed to be done, all right? The older daughter has certain rights and expectations that he's going to marry her off. But, you know, she's not an easy daughter to marry off, all right? So because it seems that she was not all that attractive. In fact, she may have been fairly unattractive. So he comes up with a scheme. Jacob's not going to really be able to complain too much about this scheme, given what he's done already to his brother. All right, this is a people that do not mind lying and cheating their own family. All right, they do it on a regular basis. So Laban, after 7 years, they have a wedding ceremony, and of course, you know, you've seen a burqa that in Afghanistan that the women wear. Well, in that culture, they would have worn heavy veils, all right? So in the wedding, all right, as he's going to this wedding ceremony, she would have been heavily veiled. He would not have been able to look at this woman and see who it is. And then he goes into his tent at night, and then she comes in, and it's pitch dark, and so he consummates the marriage with what he believes is Rachel, his beloved. He wakes up in the morning in the daylight and looks over, and it's Leah, all right? And so he's upset, and he goes to Laban and says, you have tricked me, and Laban doesn't even flinch. He doesn't apologize. He says, well, if you want Rachel, 7 more years, all right? And he is so in love with Rachel that he says, okay, I'll do it. And he works for 7 more years, and he ends up marrying Rachel, all right? He marries Rachel, his true beloved. And then he is going to bring both of his wives back eventually to the land of Canaan. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the children that are going to come from these two wives, and really also from two of their servants. Here's what's going to happen, is that Leah seems to have been relatively fertile, whereas Rachel was not. And so Leah fairly quickly is going to have 4 sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Rachel is then going to come to her husband, Jacob, and say, listen, obviously I cannot have kids. What I want you to do is take my maidservant, this is very much exactly like Sarah did, I want you to take my maidservant and have children through her for me, which he does. And that servant gives birth to 2 more sons, Dan and Naphtali. Leah, at this time, it's been several years since she has had a child, and so she believes that at this point she's not able to do so anymore. So she then comes to him with her servant. They have 2 more children by Leah's servant, Gad and Asher. Leah then gets pregnant 2 more times with Issachar and Zebulun. And then, lo and behold, Rachel gets pregnant. All right? Now, this is the youngest. This is the youngest. But this is Rachel's kid, all right? This is the one child of the one wife that he truly loves. And so he falls in love with this kid. He absolutely adores this kid. And we're going to get into that. And so what we have here, we're getting to the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, what's going to happen is that when we get to Israel, the nation is going to be divided up into 12 territories. We might call them states, except they're not states because they don't have their own independent governments. There's just 12 territories, and each of the 12 tribes are going to be given one of these territories. But one tribe will not be given territory. That is the tribe of Levi, which will become kind of a giant altar society, all right? And it's going to have the responsibility of taking care of all of the sacred places throughout the country. When the temple is finally built, they're going to be responsible for the temple. In the various towns, they will be in charge of the synagogues and the various shrines and all the religious sites. That is going to be their job. And they will not have land. They will not have territory. They will be supported by the tithes of the other tribes. All right? That's why the other tribes tithe, is in order to support this family of Levi so that they can do the work that they are supposed to do. Now, if you take out the family of Levi, the tribe of Levi, that would give you 11 tribes, right? All right? But here's what's going to happen, is that Joseph is going to have two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And Joseph then is actually going to have two tribes, all right, that come from him, because he's so important, all right, as we're going to see in this next story when we get to the story of Joseph. He is so important that he is actually going to be the father of two tribes. There's also going to be Benjamin, who I did not mention yet. Benjamin is the second son of Rachel. But he's not going to show up until much later, after all the others. All right? So those are the sons. And they are going to become extremely important because they are the 12 patriarchs. They are the 12 fathers of the tribes of Israel. Now, let's go to the next story, which is where Jacob wrestles with God. This is Genesis 32. Very strange little story. Very wonderful little story. 32, verse 23. This is again, Esau is after Jacob, and Jacob is fleeing from his brother. In the course of the night, however, Jacob arose, took his two wives and the two maidservants, his 11 children, and crossed the field, the ford of the Jabbok. After he had taken them across the stream and had brought over all his possessions, Jacob was left there alone. Then some man, all right, now again, who is this man? It's going to be indicated to us that it is an angel, and other times it's going to seem like it's God himself. And so sometimes he is described as wrestling with an angel, and sometimes he is described as wrestling with God. At this point in the book of Genesis, when an angel or a messenger of God is mentioned, it seems to be some kind of human manifestation of God himself, all right? It seems to be God in human disguise, is how they understand that. So there is this man. Then some man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. So Jacob is there by himself, and this man comes up and starts attacking him. They wrestle, and they fight all night long. When the man saw that he could not prevail over him, Jacob won't give up, he struck Jacob's hip at its socket, so that the hip socket was wrenched as they wrestled. The man then said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." "What is your name?" the man asked. He replied, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be spoken of as Jacob, but as Israel, because you have contended with divine and human beings and have prevailed." All right? You will be now Israel. So he changes his name from Jacob to Israel. This is where the whole country is going to get its name. All right? It's going to be from this new name. And of course, Jacob, Israel, is the father of these 12 sons who are the fathers of the 12 tribes, etc. So that's where the name Israel comes from. Jacob then asked him, "Dude, tell me your name, please." He answered, "Why should you want to know my name?" With that, he bade him farewell. Jacob named the place Peniel, because I have seen God face to face. He seems to believe himself, that he has seen God himself, and yet my life has been spared. strange little story. We don't know what to make out of it entirely. One of the things is that he is going to have a limp for the rest of his life. He will have a memento of this experience for the rest of his life. And it goes on and says, this is also why they do not eat the meat from the hip socket, etc. All right, seems kind of an odd thing, but there, it's a different way of looking at things than we do. Again, you know, I mentioned that Jacob's ladder, how that is an image of prayer. This story is also a powerful image of prayer as spiritual warfare. All right, spiritual warfare, which is described in different ways. Let's look at the life of Jesus. Two incidents of real spiritual warfare, prayer warfare going on in the life of Jesus. First of all, the temptations. After Jesus has been baptized, the scripture says that the Spirit drove him out into the desert where he fasted and prayed for 40 days. And at the end of that time, he was hungry. And then there is this spiritual warfare that breaks out between him and God, and Satan. The three temptations. And he wrestles with Satan, and he is victorious. It then says that that Satan left him in order to await another opportunity. Another point in Jesus' life where we see real spiritual warfare going on is in the agony in the garden. When Jesus is there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he is in warfare. He is in torment as he is praying, Father, if there is any way possible, let this cup pass me by. But your will be done. And so he is wrestling. He is wrestling with this, with his destiny and with God's plan. And so there is this battle going on within him. This is at times going to be true in our own lives. All right? Spiritual warfare is a part of most of our lives at some time where we are wrestling. Let me just give you an example where this might show up in somebody's life. All right? And I would say that somebody here has experienced this. Let's say that you are going through very real difficulties in your marriage and you're wore out and you're like, I'm done. All right, and maybe you want to have an affair. All right, you want to have an affair with somebody, you see somebody, and it's like you are so tempted. It's like, here is some comfort, here is some, you know, joy, here is some peace and happiness that I have not had here in so much time. And so there is a battle, because here's the right thing to do, and here's what I really want. All right? Here's what I really, really want to do. And so there is a war that goes on inside. All right? And we go to prayer. We go to prayer. All right? And we wrestle with this and we struggle with this, trying to find the strength to make the right decisions. It can also be, you know, if you're dealing with an addiction, all right? The whole process of hitting bottom with an addiction, of reaching a point of being able to break free of that addiction. That's spiritual warfare. Addiction is spiritual warfare, I promise you. Anybody who is dealing with an addiction of any kind knows that they are at war. They are at war for the sake of their souls and the sake of their lives, all right? And that it is, and they are not just battling with themselves, they are battling, I believe, with the evil one. I believe that spiritual warfare is something that is very real. And this image, then, the church has seen of Jacob wrestling with the angel or God or whatever, this has become an image of prayer as spiritual battle, a spiritual battle. So, and if we've gone through life and we've never had spiritual battle, you know what that means? Is that Satan has never seen us as a threat, and there's been no reason for him to enter into battle with us. All right? We just simply are not serious in our relationship with God, and therefore, we're of no threat. We're of no threat. There's nothing he needs to do to take us down. All right? There's no reason he needs to battle with us. He's got other people he can do battle with. All right? Okay. So there's that story. I'm going to jump in. I'm not going to do the whole Joseph story. If there is one story in the Old Testament that you probably know pretty well, it's the Joseph story. All right? Even Catholics know that story. All right? So I'm just going to touch on to it. I'm going to run through the story very quickly. It's an important story because it explains a lot of things about how did they end up in Egypt and what was going on there and the whole reversal of fortunes as they go from doing well to doing poorly. So again, we've already met Joseph. Joseph is the youngest son. At this point, he is the youngest son. He is the only son of Rachel, the beloved wife. And Jacob is enthralled with his son. And this son seems to be rather enthralled with himself as well. As he is growing up, he seems to have been a little full of himself. You know, we know about the coat of many colors and all this. And then he's a dreamer. And he has these incredible dreams. See, I think part of the resentment we're going to see of the brothers, too, is that they resent the way that, so this is Rachel's son. And I think they don't like the way that their mother's been treated. Right? It's been pretty obvious throughout her whole marriage that she is second-class citizen to Rachel. All right? And they know that their mother has been treated as less than this woman all of her life, and that they then are less than because of that. So there is bitterness that is here. There is anger that is here. And Jacob is not helping this situation out by being so outward about the fact that he is so in love with Rachel and he is so enthralled with this particular son and not so much with the others. But Joseph doesn't help himself either, all right? Joseph has these dreams, and he's always saying things to his brothers like, oh, I had a dream last night, guys. Let me tell you about it, all right? We were out in the field, and there were these sheaves of wheat, each one representing one of us. There were 12 of them, all right? And suddenly, tell me what you think about this, guys. All of your sheaves of wheat bowed down and worshiped me. Mine, all right? What do you think that could mean, guys? It means you're dead meat, all right? Is it? You have to die, all right? And so this goes on and on, and to the point they are fed up, and they decide, okay, we're going to kill him. One day they're out, the father sends him out with food or whatever, they're out in the fields, and they say, here comes that little twit, let's get him, all right? They take him, they throw him down into a well, they're plotting what are they going to do, some of them want to kill him. Reuben, who is the oldest brother, hates him just as much as everybody else does, but he's like, this is our brother, all right? Do we want to bring down on our heads whatever kind of curse there is for killing your little brother? But there is then this caravan that comes by, and so they said, let's sell him into slavery, all right? Just as good, he's gone, all right, but we didn't kill him. So they sell him into slavery, they take the coat of many colors, slash it up, put blood on it, come back and say, a lion attacked and killed him. This is all that's left, all right? Poor Jacob goes into grieving. Joseph then is eventually sold to a man named Potiphar. Potiphar is a very wealthy man, a very powerful man, and he begins to discover pretty quickly that he's got a really good slave here. All right? This is someone who is educated, he knows money, he knows business, and so he moves up in his household among his servants until the point that he's placed in charge. He's in charge. Now, Potiphar was not the only person in the house who was impressed with Joseph. All right? Potiphar's wife also was impressed with Joseph, found him to be quite attractive, and then so she propositions him. She throws herself at him. Joseph, recognizing that he is in a precarious situation and that if he is found to have betrayed his master, could be killed, all right, or thrown into prison or whatever, says, no, I won't do this. You know the old saying about hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, all right? Well, that's exactly what we're dealing with. She starts screaming rape, all right? He's like, you won't have me? She starts screaming rape. He is, Potiphar has him thrown into prison. All this, it's amazing. What we see here, what we have to understand, is we're seeing the amazing providence of God, the divine providence, all right? As God takes all, you know, Jacob's betrayal and deceit and the abominable sin of Joseph's brother selling him into slavery, and of Potiphar's wife's her lie and throwing him into prison, all of this is going to work out according to God's plan, all right? Or God is going to then use it. God's like a good chess player, all right? As soon as we make a move, he's got a counter move that's going to top it, all right? So he allows us that freedom to sin, but his will always win out at the end, all right? Because he is just a much better chess player than we are, all right? So he goes into prison. There he begins to develop a reputation among the other prisoners for being able to interpret dreams. Of course, Pharaoh has a dream, and no one can interpret it, none of his wizards and magicians, etc., his wise men, his advisors. So the word gets to him about this man in prison. He brings him, He tells him the dream. He sees seven fat cows come up out of the Nile, and then there are seven very skinny cows that come up out of the Nile. The seven skinny cows eat the seven fat cows. What's it mean? What's it mean? Well, he says, okay, it's very clear what it means. There are going to be 7 years of plenty, which are going to be followed by 7 years of famine. The 7 years of famine are going to eat up everything that was accumulated during the years of plenty. What you need to do is get ready for those 7 years of famine by putting somebody in charge and gathering as much food as you can, preserving as much food as you can in order to get through the famine. And so he recognizes again, as everybody seems to, this is an incredibly gifted young man. He puts him in charge. This is an important position. This is a foreigner who is now probably second in command in Egypt. All right, this is important position. He is somebody. They go through the 7 years of plenty. They come to the 7 years of famine. The famine strikes not only Egypt, but also the land of Canaan. Jacob and his sons are suffering. Jacob says, go down into Egypt, buy some food to bring it back up here. They go down, and they do that. Joseph recognizes them and decides to test them. They do not recognize him. They presume he's dead by now. All right. They certainly don't think he's, you know, gone from being a slave to being the second most powerful person in Egypt. And so he is testing them to see who they were. He asks some questions and discovers that he's got a little brother that he didn't know about. All right. Benjamin, who is his full blood brother. He is the other son of Rachel. And so he says, I want you to go back and I want you to bring your brother Benjamin down. So they go and they bring him down. And again to test them, as they're getting ready to leave to go back up, they have all the food and everything that they, the grain, he takes a silver chalice, which he puts into the bag of Benjamin. Suddenly comes out and says, wait, somebody has stolen my silver chalice. He goes through, they search it, and Benjamin, they take him, and he says, we're going to throw him into prison. Please don't do this. This will break our father's heart. He's already lost one son, Joseph, this will absolutely kill him. Joseph sees that they have changed. They are not the same despicable characters that they were. He bursts into tears and tells them who he is, sends them back up. They go back up and get their father Jacob, and he comes down. They all live there happily ever after, it would seem. All right. Now, what happens is that eventually Jacob will die, and they take him back up to the land of Canaan and bury him there, and then they come back down to Egypt. When Joseph, and then at that point, the brothers are going to get nervous, all right? They're concerned. It's like, okay, Jacob's dead. Maybe that's what Joseph's been waiting for, all right? Joseph's just been waiting till he is dead, and now he's going to get his retribution for what we did. So they go and they throw themselves at his mercy. They beg his forgiveness, and he grants that. The last scene is the death of Joseph. All right, Joseph tells the people that the Jewish people, the Hebrew people, they're not Jewish yet. There's no Jewish religion. They are just simply the Hebrew people. He tells them that when they eventually leave Egypt and go back to the land of Canaan, that has been promised, that they will take his bones with them. All right, and which they will. They will. When Moses and they take, when they leave, they will take the bones of Joseph with them. We see that they are now in Egypt. This is how the Hebrew people got into Egypt. This is how that whole story got started. How they went from this group of wandering Arameans over in Mesopotamia. Now they are down and they are in Egypt itself. And this is going to go on for about 400 years. The scriptures are going to, the book of Exodus, which we're going to start with next time, is going to tell us very early on. There was a new king or new pharaoh who did not know Joseph. All right, and things are going to be very, very different. We just did a whirlwind. We just did three of the patriarchs. And so I want to just take a couple minutes here if there's any questions. Yes? The next meeting will be, I think it's the 3rd of January. It's the Wednesday after the 1st, whatever that is. I think, yeah, that's the 3rd. And we will begin chapter 7, where we're going to get into the book of Exodus. And again, now we're getting back into some more meaty. Tonight, what we were doing is important stories, but it's not the real meaty stuff that we've dealt with in some of the other chapters. All right? So, yes?
Will we do... the next chapter on One Night?
I don't know yet. She's asking will we do the next chapter on One Night. Probably not, because it's the Exodus. It's too important. There's too much there for me to do it all in one night. There will be occasionally there will be chapters where I'll do it all in one night. Make sure you, if you have not read all of this book of Genesis, make sure you do. All right, that's what you're, why we're doing this, is so that you can actually read the scriptures. It's not enough to just simply read about the scriptures. I don't want you just reading this book, even though it quotes extensively. All right, but it gives you reading assignments to do. All right, but what you want to do is you want to actually read the Bible. All right, because the more that you read it, the more comfortable you're going to become with it, and it's going to become just, it's going to become a great friend. It's going to become a great friend to you. It's going to become a great, great source of inspiration and guidance and direction, and that's what it's intended to be. And that's why I'm doing this, all right, is to empower you to actually read the Bible itself. All right, this is not just for kind of idle curiosity's sake. All right, so let's stand and close. Everybody have a Merry Christmas. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Thank you all.